I'm very pleased to welcome back to Fremantle Shipping News and View from the Roundhouse Political Podcast, Professor Martin Drum. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning, Michael. Great to be here.
Well, it's good to see that we're both still alive and here to talk about what's going on in the world. There's always something momentous happening, Martin. There's a shadow cabinet, and we'll come back and talk about it. That's pretty momentous, given their track record in recent times. And we should also talk, I think, about the Bangladesh election recently and how the Bangladeshis are getting on with the Indians. The good thing is they can probably resolve most of their diplomatic differences with a good game of cricket. I'm not sure, though, that cricket's going to help out much in the other parts of the world. And we should just quickly survey them. Martin, what's going on, do you think, in Ukraine at the moment? Are the Russians and the Ukraine going to come to some happy result?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there across the board, I think. So, yeah, we're going to cross the national and international borders.
Well, they've been meeting, haven't they?
Yes, so let's start off with the Security Summit in Berlin and talk through a little bit about that. This is where European leaders got together, of course, with the famous speech from Marco Rubio, where he kind of said, "We still want to be your friends and allies, but by the way, Europe's going down the gurgler." And he's quite blunt about that second point. So half of the reporting was around how he said he still wants to be friends with Europe. The other half was around him paying out on Europe because of its too multicultural and selling out on its traditional roots. So it depends on which take you want to have there. I think that probably he's a bit more conventional than Trump, but he's in Trump's administration, so he's walking that tightrope. And of course, as foreign minister, effectively foreign minister of the US, he's trying to, maintain these relationships whilst at the same time use Trumpian rhetoric. Michael, so that's where he sort of entered the fray. But broadly speaking, there was a sizable discussion around how to deal with a whole range of major conflicts. I didn't think, Michael, that it got a long way on Ukraine. European leaders are now getting more pessimistic than they've been in the past about a favourable outcome there. I think it's amounting to them perhaps resigning or preparing for a worst-case scenario. In Gaza, there's a commitment to be involved in the rebuilding of Gaza post-war, which is good, of course. And I think they're very keen to see the tensions between the US and Iran de-escalate. But of course, it does. I think the problem is it does sort of remind us a bit, in military terms, Europe is a bit impotent at the moment, and that's why they're spending a lot of money on the military, and they've upped defence spending to try to be more consequential in these discussions.
Well, you get the impression that in relation to Iran, that Trump's wanting them to know that he's got everything aimed at them just at the moment.
Trump's it's at an interesting juncture there because, we've warned earlier that this could go very, very badly, and he's brought all the forces to bear. They're all sitting outside, aircraft carriers and a whole fleet of both ships and planes ready to strike. But at the same time, I think he's worried about getting entangled in a broader conflict. So there is discussions here, but unless the US gets something tangible out of this, then again, he's bluffed to no effect. So they really need an outcome, and I think it's certainly around the nuclear missiles that Iran has. But what will happen with Iran's broader geopolitical activity in the Middle East, such as Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis in Yemen, all of those things, Michael? I think that's the really interesting flashpoint there.
And what about this Board of Peace? I mean, thankfully, from my point of view, Australia hasn't joined it. It looked like they were seriously entertaining it for a while.
Look, I think a couple of countries like Australia made polite noises because they like to have a good relationship with Trump. But Very few countries have actually, Western style countries like us have actually signed up for this. There are countries that are talking about perhaps using observer status, like Italy and others. But the ones that have actually signed up are probably not your usual US allies. There are places like Hungary and then a series of other areas, such as throughout Asia and other places like that. So you're not getting those traditional allies of the US signing up for this.
Well, I mean, it's just a Trump fest, is it? Isn't it? They met in Washington yesterday. The New York Times has some fabulous lines in their report on what happened. Trump, he told tall tales, cracked old jokes, got people to pay money into something he's named after himself, hyped up his wife's movie, trashed his enemies, aired familiar grievances, congratulated himself, brought along top members of his government, and then kicked back while they congratulated him. So much about the meeting was highly unorthodox.
Yeah, look, here's some examples, Michael, of the Board of Peace. Okay. Argentina, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Bahrain, Bulgaria, El Salvador, Hungary, Indonesia, it's quite interesting, Israel, Jordan, Kazakhstan, Kosovo, Mongolia, Morocco, Pakistan, Paraguay, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, United Arab Emirates, US, of course, we talked about that, and Uzbekistan. So you're not talking about the usual movers and shakers there, are you?
You're not. Martin, it's, in some ways, it's all laughable. It's like a stand-up comedy show. But we're still waiting to see what happens in Iran, still waiting to see what happens in Gaza. Is it going to be rebuilt? Is Hamas going to lay down their arms? And is peace, as we thought we knew it, ever going to be restored in Ukraine? Well, I guess we can just say we have to keep watching and waiting, Martin.
Certainly, and we've heard various noises about Gaza about moving to the next stage. Until we see a meaningful transitional authority being implemented in the Gaza Strip, I'm not sure we're going to get much progress. And that's the difficult one because it has to have confidence and respect from all the different players here. Israel would need to respect them, but so would Hamas, for instance. So it's actually quite, that's the hard bit, but it's necessary if you're going to have a lasting peace.
Well, let's talk about something a whole lot easier to talk about. Well, maybe it's more complicated. I'm not sure. Were you surprised when Tim Wilson got the job as Shadow Treasurer in the newly formed Angus Taylor Shadow Ministry?
Yeah, now on the shadow cabinet, a lot of the stuff was fairly predictable. A lot of Angus Taylor's backers, people from the more right-wing side of the party, got rewarded, and some of Suzanne Ley's closer supporters, like Melissa Price, missed out. But yes, certainly Wilson is an exception to that, as a well-known moderate in inner city urban electorate. There, Michael. He is known as a economic thinker. He's made a lot of public statements and the like around this. And I think that Angus Taylor needs some good ideas in that space around reform, economic reform. So he's obliged to lean on him. And of course, it brings him in the tent, doesn't it, Michael? So there's always a bit of that any new leader needs to consider.
He also just won back from Attiel, who was it, Zoe Daniel, the seat that he holds in Melbourne. And I suppose if he's the shadow treasurer, it might help him to keep it next time round.
He's the only liberal to win back a seat from the Teals, only one. So I mean that's a pretty significant effort, and he's also one of the very few liberals left in the lower house that has a seat in the areas where the liberals need to win. So his views are pretty important in that respect.
Well, what are the other notables in this? Well, I suppose we say that Hastie, who I predicted would take over the leadership some time ago and predicted incorrectly, but he comes back in a into the shadow cabinet in a strange sounding job, new industry and sovereign capability portfolio. What's that all about?
So I think it's about giving him some license to come up with ideas that would shift the dial for the coalition, allowing him to dwell on, and you've seen his social media posts, Michael. I think a lot of our listeners will have, about manufacturing and other things and economic nationalism. He may be able to get a few ideas up through this kind of portfolio, but without perhaps upending the whole coalition narrative. So I think that's probably what it's around, getting him involved in a few projects.
Maybe Pearson Swan, Western Australian made shoes, will come back under that policy, Martin.
Well, it's a bit Trumpian in terms of its economic nationalism, and it's a lot harder said than done, as the car industry demonstrated. How many decades did we heavily subsidize the car industry? We still found it difficult making our cars competitive with imported cars. So these things are quite tricky to actually pull off. We'll see what ideas emanate from this, Michael.
Well, Senator Jane Hume, she's in the upper house. You don't normally get your top leaders out of the Senate, but she's the deputy Liberal leader after everything that's happened, and got the chance to choose what she wanted, apparently, employment and industrial relations portfolio. You can certainly make a lot of conservative sounding noises in those portfolios, Martin.
It is a bit of an opportunity for her. I was a bit curious you didn't choose something else, major. But in the eyes of the Liberals, I think there's a lot of problems on the IR front that they can exploit. So they obviously they'll go after the unions, but they'll also point to restrictive work practices as holding back business and therefore acting as a brake on the economy. So I'd expect her to pursue that line of questioning, I think.
Yes, well, you just have to pick up the latest media releases from the bosses' associations, and your lines are written for you, I think, Madam. Sarah Henderson, who we hear a lot about, I think a former journalist, has been given the communications portfolio. That wouldn't surprise anyone.
Yeah, I think that's probably a natural portfolio for her, and she has been fairly critical of the ABC, but also her former employer,
Yes.
Michael, but also generally a range of other media settings anyway, even when she was on the back bench. So I think she probably lobbied for that, I'd suggest.
It's amazing how many conservatives seem to want to bag the ABC. They seem to forget people like Sarah Henderson inhabit it as well. But we'll treat that as a comment. And Jacinta Numpa-Jimpa Price is back, and she's the Shadow Minister for Skills and Training. That'll be interesting, Martin.
I was curious. I'm not surprised she's back. I think that she left under Susan Ley. I think she's clearly more nationalist than the Susan Ley narrative was. It wasn't a good fit for her. I'd still think this could be a tricky one. I'm not quite sure how good a fit that is for her, and I suspect one of the dangers is she often goes off script. And has consistently since joining the Liberal Party. In fact, since going to Parliament, so it'll be interesting to see if that continues under Angus Taylor.
I suppose the topics of skills and training can be worked into anything about which she likes to sound off, Martin. We'll watch the nightly news to see how she first manages to segue from one thing to the other. Another key Taylor ally, John O'Donoghue, who we've sort of seen a lot of during the reformation of the Liberal Party. Has home affairs, but then he had it before, but also gets immigration. So I suppose we're going to hear a lot from him, Martin. How influential is he?
Well, this is the curious thing. We had this leaked policy on immigration that was sitting on the desk of Susan Ley. It was apparently written by her office because John O'Dea and a few others that were in the key portfolios knew nothing about it, they said. I think this is plausible deniability, perhaps, because it ruffled some feathers and in discriminating against whole countries. It was very One Nation-esque.
Wanted to do what Trump did, nominate a whole lot of countries from whom we weren't going to let anyone come into the country.
That's right. That's right. It's quite Trumpian in its settings. So I think a change of leader allowed everyone to say, well, that was all the leader's fault and nothing to see here. I suspect they'll be recalibrated under Angus Taylor, but I also expect that they'll be fairly hard line on immigration because they know that that's been gaining traction for One Nation.
Now, Michaelia Cash, West Australian, she's quite senior in the ranks these days, and she's Attorney General shadow. She was that before. I suppose that's what one would have expected. She'll continue to be happy.
I think she's seen as a key spokesperson out of Western Australia, and she's possibly, alongside Hastie, I'd say the most vocal members here in WA, and that's a pretty significant portfolio at AG level federal.
Well, then you look keep on looking amongst the Senate. They've actually pulled a whole lot of talent out here. The Tasmanian Senator Claire Chandler is said to be one of the big winners, and she gets to watch what Katie Gallagher is doing as finance minister. Really important jobs, those finance type, economic type portfolios, Martin.
Very important and a big jump for Senator Chandler. She comes out of Tasmania, so one of the smaller states. And I think there was a bit of surprise at that promotion. And obviously, he sees something in her. We'll see how it goes when it comes to performance. And that's a big opportunity for her to make a dent.
There's other people mentioned who I must confess I'd never heard of. Victorian Aaron Violi comes in as the Shadow Minister for Science, Technology and Digital Economy. And Phil Thompson, who's identified as a conservative, I suppose, has been promoted to Shadow Cabinet in charge of defence personnel. But interestingly, going into defence is James Patterson.
That doesn't surprise me too much. He probably angled for that. Defence is one of the biggest portfolios. James Patterson was probably one of the most effective performers since the election. Not that that's a high bar for the Liberals haven't really cut through. I think they will admit that as well as anyone else, Michael. But I think he was out and about quite regularly, to be fair. And his intervention, talking about the loss of support under Lay, was, I think, instrumental in her numbers disappearing by the time of the ballot. So he's a very significant player at the moment and quite influential. So that's a big portfolio, but it doesn't come as a surprise to me.
The one that came as a surprise to me was that Ted O'Brien, who was holding the Treasury portfolio under Susan Lee, is taking on foreign affairs.
I'm surprised by that too. Firstly, he said that he wouldn't mind staying as treasurer, shadow treasurer, and obviously didn't get his wish there. But he did remain loyal to Susan Ley. He ran again for deputy leader against Jane Hume. I thought he might have been on the outer. As we've said with Wilson, I think it's not a bad idea to keep a broad range of people in your team. You can't only have people from the same faction or group with you. Even so, I still think it's an unusual choice for foreign affairs because you've got to be out and about, shaking hands, and you've got to be an enthusiastic networker and quite charismatic. It doesn't seem to be incompetent or anything, Ted O'Brien, but I wouldn't have probably pictured him as one of the most charismatic members of the team.
I thought he was only interested in nuclear power stations, but there you go. Mind you, they are.
I was a bit surprised. I just thought you'd probably get someone a bit more with different attributes in that particular role. Someone who gets out there and prosecutes the case. And there's a lot going on in foreign affairs. We talk about it every week. So, I think there's an opportunity. There's a good opportunity there, but it's got to be the right person.
Well, maybe we'll invite Ted onto our podcast to talk foreign affairs with us. I suppose another way of looking at it, Martin, is to say who else might have been interested in the job and or otherwise equipped and competent to do it. No one much comes to mind, I have to say. Michaelia Cash might have liked it.
She's obviously been there, and famously, Julie Bishop was foreign minister out of Western Australia for a long, long time. But there's a WA is a long way from the action when it comes to all of the shindigs and functions and everything else that you have to do in the international diplomatic scene from WA. So it's probably a pretty difficult portfolio to pull off from here, I'd say.
Well, we are close to China, though, Martin. Dan Tehan, another certainly supporter, I suppose one would say, retains energy. He's been banging on about nuclear power, of course, before the deposing of Susan Lee, and he's now the manager of opposition business, which is always an interesting job. It seems to me it's an absolutely full-time job.
Dan Tehan is reasonably well regarded internally. He ran for deputy leader and didn't get much support. Seems to undermine what I said just then, but I think he's regarded as pretty competent within the party generally. He did desert Suzanne Ley on the eve of the ballot, but he was by no means Robinson Crusoe in that respect. I'm not surprised that he's staying in a reasonably high-profile position, and as someone who's put a lot of energy into that space,
Oh, excuse me, pardon.
I was totally unintentional.
So you then suddenly realise we've only been talking about the Liberals, which is important to see who's followed Angus or who Angus has flicked out, his hook to, and pulled in. But then you've got the Country Party, the Nationals. Now, how does that work? Does Taylor have any say over what goes on there, or does David Littleproud, the leader of the Nationals, say here are our boys, here are our numbers, and these are the jobs they're going to be doing?
So the number of he has no say really in the number of nationals that are in shadow cabinet normally, because that's set out under the agreements that are signed after each election when the numbers are determined overall. So they've got effectively a quota, the nationals in the shadow cabinet, but he does negotiate with the leader of the nationals around their portfolios. So he has some say in that respect. I thought that one the most curious thing about the Nationals was he declared he put a line under all of the shenanigans beforehand, said fresh start, no pun more punishment for those national senators that national MPs that desert that cross the floor or whatever, and you're back in. And in one way, that's probably smart to draw a line under that. The other hand, I think there's a number of Liberals that were really unhappy with how Nationals didn't abide by shadow cabinet rules. And that probably leads, there'll be some bad blood sitting there for the future, maybe.
It'd be remiss of me, Martin, not to mention some others are in the shadow cabinet who are old-fashioned in that sense, moderates, but I think very well respected. For example, the Senator from New South Wales, Andrew Bragg, he stays in the shadow role of Housing Minister, and interestingly picks up environment, which is a pretty important portfolio. And Ruston retains health and ageing. And remains deputy leader of the opposition in the Senate. So, I mean, it's not a wholesale purging, is it, of the so-called moderates? And Julian Lisa retains education as well as being Shadow Minister for Indigenous Affairs, remembering, of course, that he was a supporter of The Voice, almost a lone one in the Conservative ranks at the time.
Some interesting selections there. Julian Lisa, whilst he is known as, famous for being one of the few coalition MPs to support The Voice, is generally reasonably conservative on a range of issues and not necessarily moderate, despite that. Well, not really a moderate. Andrew Bragg is an interesting guy. He's probably the most best known moderate in the team. He would have been good for foreign affairs or something like that, because he is very good at pressing the flesh, getting out and about. And as a senator from New South Wales, I don't think he's got clear obligations to the electorate that are too difficult to manage around that. I'd pick him as someone going into a role like that in the future. And being a mover and shaker, he is a numbers man for the moderates. Again, having him in that inside the tent is much smarter than outside.
Well, Martin, any early indications from what Angus Taylor has said about what he's thinking, what he thinks is important, what we're going to hear more of?
Well, there was a number of sort of Nod's first broad generic statements like Australian values, but he has given some hints here. Certainly, he's stated that he wants to work on economic reform. That's his background. He's stated that he's going to be hardline on immigration, so keep an eye out for that. And he's talked about the cost of living. We haven't had much in terms of specifics yet there. So they're the main things that he's mentioned so far. It's possible that nuclear energy is back on the table. We'll see. We haven't had a firm commitment. There's been nods and winks in that direction so far. We'll see how far they go down that angle. People like Senator Matt Canavan are much more enthusiastic about him and have a better relationship with him than they did with Lay, and he's very enthusiastic about nuclear power. So there'll be some voices in his ears to go back to that policy.
Well, we'll, as always, be watching with interest. Martin, I've been watching with interest what's been going on in Bangladesh. We've had very topsy-turvy politics there. One faction in government gets kicked out, another one takes over, then they get kicked out, another one comes in. Recent elections have brought the old party back. But one of the great problems in politics in what we call the subcontinent area is you've got Muslim country Pakistan on one side and Muslim country largely Bangladesh on the other, and India doesn't always get on with either of them. But tell us, what do you make of the recent Bangladesh elections? Is it settling things down?
Of course, it's too early to tell. You see over time the impacts of elections, but this was a bit of an earthquake in a way. It was a landslide victory for the Bangladesh Nationalist Party. And as a more robust Bangladesh First campaign that was produced there, they've got a lot, fairly sweeping mandate. And the one country, I think you've hinted at this, that they've had a poor relationship with is India. And so, in the short term, I think there's going to be tensions in that relationship. You mentioned cricket as a potential bridge, but actually, a bit like Pakistan, Bangladesh has pulled out of the 2020 World Cup.
So did Australia, Martin.
And that's due to tensions. Well, Australia pulled out, but in different ways for
Well,
performance reasons.
let the bats and ball today and got thrashed.
I think we didn't have any choice about being turfed out of the World Cup. They never got in the first place. Well, yeah, they boycotted it basically. That doesn't bode well for that relationship if cricket can't bridge that gap. I suspect, like a lot of things, that relationship will thaw over time, and there might be some better outcomes in the medium term, but that's where they're at right at the moment.
Well, the former Bangladeshi Prime Minister is now holed up in India because the new government bought her, put her up on charges and convict her and sent her to jail. That's a hard thing to deal with, isn't it?
I mean, the real problem with Bangladesh, which hasn't been resolved despite that former authoritarian prime minister being toppled, is there's underlying governance structures that are not very robust and not very effective. And it does, even if you've got a sweeping election win by a different party, does that really change that? I think that's really what's needed. It's good governance that would make a big difference here.
Well, Martin, it's nearly the weekend. I think we can rest our minds and hope that the world has a peaceful weekend. They're still killing each other in Sudan, I notice, and no doubt in many other parts of the world. But let's hope we in Australia can remain calm amidst all the turmoil. Do you think we can?
Well, we'll do our best. We'll do our best, Michael. That's all you can ask of us.
I'll see you next Friday, Martin.
Pleasure as always.